Well, it's good to be here with familiar faces. It wasn't too long ago when what was it? 20 years ago when I was at the Black Hole Bar. No, what did we call it back then? What did we call the bar?
Bistro, Black Hole
The Black
Bistro.
Hole Bistro.
The H bar.
The H Bar, that's right, on King Street, the old bar when Perimeter first opened up, and now Perimeter has taken over the world of theoretical physics. And here I am giving the talk. Can't believe it. Anyway, this is I'm hoping that this talk becomes more of a conversation, more of a discussion. It started a while ago when Lee when we knew the cosmological constant was here to stay. And Lee started to think about that in the context of non-perturbative quantum gravity. He was in New York when he was working on that paper. And that inspired me to also think very seriously. As much as I love string theory and still work on it, for other approaches to think about the cosmological constant in quantum gravity. A lot has been done. I'm not going to give full credit, and I apologize for those who I've overlooked in this presentation. But this talk is mainly designed to evoke inspiration and to I don't know what the word is, to inconvenience you in how you might think about quantum gravity with a cosmological constant. I am a cosmologist, so I'm going to be coming at this from that perspective. Okay, so let's begin. So this is these are my most of this work is based on a paper that was recently published in Classical and Quantum Gravity with João Meguejo and my postdoc Gabe Herzeg. And there's been some ongoing discussions with Laurent. Hopefully we that I'll be proud to say I might end up writing my very first paper with Laurent after knowing him for 25 years. So this is based on also some references. I want to just provide the references because I'm lazy and I hate cutting and pasting references into the slides. So some papers, not just one, but a couple of papers that João Meguejo had re recently written, very interesting papers that I have. I would say judiciously, cut and pasted some of his nice diagrams onto my slide. Some work done by myself, Marina Cortez, Andrew Little, João, and Lee. We wrote two papers. I'm citing one of them. Sorry about that. And the paper with me, João, and a review by Vilenkin, which includes a lot of salient references. So what is the goal here? The goal, for me, at least when we think about quantum cosmology, is exactly the word quantum and cosmology. And my thinking of how I think about quantum cosmology is really coming from that we do have a framework of the early universe through which we can actually understand something about what the ground state of the universe might be. We have very good evidence, both theoretically and observationally, that that paradigm looks, smells, talks, and quacks like cosmic inflation. I am also very supportive and sympathetic and have worked on alternatives to inflation. But in today's talk, I'm going to be coming from the perspective of inflation, although some of this discussion will not evade other alternatives such as balancing cosmologies, cyclic cosmologies, or emergent cosmologies. But I'm just, I want to be, and for the sake of concreteness, I'm going to talk about in the context of inflation. And, since the 80s, when Hawking and Hoddle and then many others formulated the idea that there can be a wave function of the entire universe, meaning a quantum space-time through which there's a wave function that describes that quantum space-time and also fluctuations. With the seminal paper by Halliwell and Hawking showing that the perturbations of this wave function also leads to it agrees with the perturbations that we do in cosmology, where we treat classical De Sitter space and we look at quantum fluctuations, that this can all be understood as well. Modulo certain, and I'll talk about some, certain technical and conceptual issues, a picture of cosmic inflation. But the issue has always been that when we think about quantum cosmology, and I'll talk about, I'll be more precise what I mean by that concretely, we're usually limited to mini superspace. So what do I mean by that? Let me be more concrete about my outlook here. Well, normally, if we think of doing a non-perturbative quantization of gravity, normally, I mean, what we are, with exception to, you know, loop quantum gravity and spin foam like models, and, you know, other non-perturbative models, our way in, at least pragmatically, so that we can do calculations, is that we start with the classical theory. In this case, we take the Wheeler DeWitt equation, some Hamiltonian with other constraints. We symmetry reduce that the Wheeler DeWitt equation, the classical solution, down to, say, a homogeneous and isotropic metric. And then we quantize. We promote to operators, we do operator ordering, and then we quantize. But the real dream, at least if you want to do things a la Hamiltonian, is to start with the classical theory, quantize directly, and then symmetry reduce. And so today's talk is going to be about the second option here, whether or not we can actually do this. And I'm going to argue that there is a pathway, okay? There's a pathway using the Chern-Simons-Kadama state that allows us to actually do actually both, but actually more precisely do the second option. And it paves a new way maybe of how we might think about doing quantum cosmology without limiting ourselves only to symmetry reduced cases. So just a little bit of review, what we normally do when we wanna do Wheeler DeWitt quantizations, we take our action and we're gonna restrict ourselves to general relativity with a cosmological constant. And we have Hawken and Gibbons instructors to have a boundary term. We might have some matter fields. And what we do is we do a 3+1 decomposition, an ADM decomposition, where we have a lapse vector that will evolve our three surface in time. And we have our shift vectors that can take track of the twisting of a space-time surface. And we can write down a different variant action by tracking now the three metric and its canonical conjugate pi ij. If we had a matter field, okay, if we had a matter field, we would have some scalar and its thing, but we're gonna ignore this. Okay, I'm gonna be sloppy. There might be times where it pops in and pops out, okay? And we'll have a Hamiltonian constraint and a vector constraint. And for our purposes, we're gonna focus on a Hamiltonian constraint. So we have our DeWitt supermetric, which is a metric on what we call a construct called superspace. And the momentum conjugate, the three Ricci, cosmological constant, and any matter fields. Now, if we restrict ourselves to mini superspace, so if we promote now, if we want to do quantization, we promote this canonical conjugate of the three metric to functional derivatives with respect to some state that we try to solve with. And we are instructed, if we were working in Lorentzian space-time, to do what Feynman instructed us to do, which is that you path integrate. In the case, the dynamical variable will be the metric, the free metric. So we path integrate over the free metric, as well as if you had any matter fields. And if you're working in mini superspace, then basically, I'm just gonna simplify life a lot. Now I'm gonna restrict myself to a scale factor as the only degree of freedom. So I have a homogeneous and isotropic space-time, and my Hamiltonian constraint becomes very simple, okay? And instead of d by dhij, this simply becomes d by dA, where A is derivative of respect to the scale factor. And we pick up a term here. You might figure this term looks something like the Hubble friction term. And there's some potential. Now, in the case where I have a cosmological constant, the potential takes on the following form. And if you do a redefinition, and I call zeta, let me call it Z for now, okay? I do a redefinition. This equation looks like a one-dimensional quantum mechanics problem with a potential. And the potential is a linear potential. So I'm gonna ask some of you, you geniuses in the audience, I'll pick on somebody, to tell me what that you've seen this equation before, and you can tell me what that corresponds. There's a quantum mechanical problem that this equation becomes identical to. I'm gonna pick on Niaish. What does that look like, Niaish?
It's a quartic oscillator. I don't know.
Well, it's a linear potential, right? Z is a function of, yeah. So psi is a function of Z only. Right? Right. It's the Airy function.
It's Airy function, yeah.
That's right. Very good. So let's look at this. So that I liberally stole a very nice diagram from Alex Vilenkin's excellent review. And here is a potential, right? So the potential basically, this is a scale factor. Where the scale factor goes to zero, you have a region under the potential and you have a potential barrier. And if this is a one-dimensional quantum mechanical problem, we know how to think about this problem. This is nothing more than barrier penetration in quantum mechanics. So what we should expect is that inside this barrier, I can tunnel, and outside I can oscillate. So the classically forbidden regions are the regions underneath this potential. That's where my tunneling could occur. And outside of the potential is where I'm gonna have I can have the classically allowed solutions. The same way if I have a particle penetrating a barrier where the argument of the potential and the kinetic energy meaning for states where the kinetic energy where the kinetic energy is imaginary, classically forbidden regions, this is where I'll have an instanton or a tunneling process. And this corresponds to, so I have psi t. Now, I want to kind of use a slide. For many years, there was a lot of debate about the no boundary proposal, the Hartle-Hawkins state, or the tunneling wave function. And this is resurfaced, of course, by locals at Perimeter Institute, led by Neil and Jesus Christ, a handful of really smart people who want to look at the wave function of the universe in Lorentzian spaces only. But I wanted to use this example to kind of highlight that these different boundary conditions that we might call the Hartle-Hawkins state, the so-called no boundary state, and the Vilenkin tunneling state correspond to just different boundary conditions. So for a generic behavior of a particle going through a potential well. Okay, in the case of the Hartle-Hawkins state, the boundary condition is chosen such that the wave function vanishes, right, and then oscillates. And that will correspond also to choosing Euclidean sections of my space-time. The tunneling wave function or the Vilenkin wave function will correspond to Lorentzian space-times where I tunnel underneath the barrier and then I come out and it's a traveling wave that is tunneling out of this, we call this, so remember the x-axis is a scale factor, and this is a one dimension in mini superspace. So we have an outgoing wave that tunnels through. The Hartle-Hawkins state is a standing wave, right? That actually has oscillations forwards and backwards and vanishes. When the scale factor goes to zero or when we approach the singularity. Okay. Now, all of this so far was done using this approach where the dynamical variable is the metric over the superspace. And I'm just gonna say that I don't know how to define. If I wanted to go beyond mini superspace, okay? I want to just avoid the conversations about, am I doing Euclidean? Am I doing Lorentzian? What boundary conditions should I choose? What, you know, but the thing for me that's the danger here is I don't know how to define this DG, okay? So I'm just gonna avoid this question and sidestep it altogether and work with new variables. And this is where the Ashtakov formalism is useful. So this is like my one slide. So you know, my one slide with a bunch of stuff in it. So bear with me. If I define a curvature two form in terms of, so I and J runs over SL2C variables or SO31 complexified variables. So this is my spin connection. I could define my curvature two form the following way, and I could write down my Einstein-Hilbert action by properly contracting that guy. If I project this connection in the following way, so I project it into a complex piece, so I'm doing a three-dimensional projection of the spin connection, I can get to what we call a self-dual and an anti-self-dual connection, where the internal index is a SU2 complex variable, or SL2C, and I have like a alpha in this case will be a spatial index. And as a result, let me see if I have another slide, yeah. Okay. So as a result, I can, you know, I'll have a Hamiltonian constraint. So I can rewrite my Hamiltonian constraint. So I'm just reviewing in my own way, you know, how to rewrite the Hamiltonian constraint and the old metric variables in terms of the Ashtakov variables. And the key here is once you have this Ashtakov connection, actually let's go here. So I can basically take my extrinsic curvature, my spin connection, right? And relate the, a linear combination of those two things, which is correspond to the first and the second term here. So this will be the spin connection, the extrinsic curvature, and this will be the spin connection. So the minute I take the spin connection, the extrinsic curvature from the old variables, I can actually write down this Ashtakov connection and my Hamiltonian constraint. And I'm just jumping immediately to saying, if I have this Hamiltonian constraint and the Ashtakov variables, right? And they are given to me by this, they're given to me by this term here, okay? So this Ashtakov connection is dual to a densitized triad. So this should be this densitized triad E and E here, but I'm writing it down functionally. And this contains the information of the rest of the Hamiltonian constraint S. And that S is a magnetic component of the curvature tensor. And D by DA is the densitized triad. So what I'm just trying to do here is to show that there is a state, I'm now calling it psi of A, that annihilates all three constraints of general relativity in ADM formalism. And that state was the object that Lee Smolin was working on 20 years ago, called the Chern-Simons Kadama state. And what that state is just an exponential of the Chern-Simons three form, okay? So why does that work? So let's focus our attention on this slide here. Now I'm gonna slow down a little bit here because this is some new stuff. And this is some work that is reporting from one of Joao's recent paper. So this is a Hamiltonian constraint, and you're probably seeing this I and this R here. So remember I told you that this connection is has a real and imaginary part, right? The SL2C connection, real part is the spin connection, the imaginary part is the extrinsic curvature. So this just means the imaginary part of the connection, the Ashtakov connection, and the spin connection is a real part of the Ashtakov connection. So I can rewrite the real Hamiltonian constraint by taking the real part of the curvature tensor right? The electric field is real to begin with, the densitized triad. And I can now try to solve for the state, all right? So I'm basically, I'm plugging in for a non-degenerate metric. So this is the densitized triad. I'm applying this equation to this state. So I wherever I see my E, I take a D by D A acting on psi. And what I find is that I pull down, if psi is this Chern-Simon state, this magnetic component. So indeed, this Chern-Simon state solves the constraint. But there's one caveat that I want to bring to mind here. Because I've used this imaginary part of the Chern-Simon state to get the real part of the magnetic field, right? Because I've done that, notice that the imaginary part of this Chern-Simon state here, okay, for the Lorentzian case comes with an I. That's very important. Because so I don't want to go through, if you look at one, for example, I think Lee's review is a very good one here, where Lee, he finds the Euclidean Chern-Simon state and the Lorentzian Chern-Simon state. If you write the Euclidean and the Lorentzian, let's just focus on the Euclidean case. Sorry. If you focus on the Lorentzian case, you're working with the self-dual variables, right? Which has the real part of the connection and the imaginary part of the connection. And what happens for that state is that you pull up either a plus or a minus sign in the exponent here. But if I only use the real part of the connection, for the Lorentzian case, the I survives. So what we have here is a Lorentzian case. If I only restrict myself to the real part to the real part of the Hamiltonian, I have a Lorentzian case that is delta function normalizable. All right. So this slide I've pretty much summarized Joao's recent paper. And so I don't want to take all my time trying. You should invite Joao to talk about this. Look at that paper. And I hope I did a little bit of justice to trying to show, but the upshot is if I restrict myself to the imaginary connection, the minute I do this, the part of the connection, the Kadama state, the associated Kadama state in the Lorentzian case is going to be delta function normalizable. And so a lot of the problems, like for example, that Witten brought up and other people, kind of goes out of the window, at least in the case where I have delta function normalizable states. So now we can make a little bit more progress. And what we're going to do now is we have a new canonical commutation relation, which relates the imaginary part, okay, of the full connection with the electric, with the densitized triad. So we have a different commutation relation. And now what I can do is I can symmetry reduce. Okay, so this is I can symmetry reduce this case. So what do I mean by that? It means that I should have been able to tell you that the scale factor, did I have it somewhere else here? I forgot to include something. So wait, I should have included it. Hold on a second. Yeah. I'm giving away all my slides.
While you look for the slide, I think Lee has a question.
Yes, Lee.
Just a comment. I think you want to say that the scale factor is A and the B is the connection.
Yeah, that's what I want to say, but I'm frustrated that I didn't write it down. So that's right. So if I symmetry reduce, the scale factor becomes abelian, so the scale factor A becomes proportional. The connection, the full connection becomes proportional to the scale factor small a, okay? The connection becomes proportional to A dot, and A dot is equal to B, where A dot is the scale factor. the time derivative of the scale factor. So as Lee correctly said, when I symmetry reduce, the full connection becomes proportional to what I call B, small b. And E, the densitized triad, becomes proportional to the scale factor squared.
Right.
Okay. And so the commutation relation of the full A and E becomes B, which is analogous to the symmetry reduced connection, and E, the densitized triad, becomes this. Okay. And therefore, when I quantize, I can think if I can promote B to an operator, which is D by DA squared. Just follows from this commutation relation. Therefore, my symmetry reduced Hamiltonian constraint becomes D by DB and B squared. And the general solution, the solution of the Chern-Simon states, simply symmetry reduced to B cubed K plus B. And I want us to now go back to the old variables. The old variables look like this, D by DA squared, 1 over A, D by DA, and U of A. Okay. But because we know that A and E are canonically conjugate, so if they're canonically conjugate, we can think of this as sort of like X and P in quantum mechanics, where X is position and P is momentum. There, if we have functions of X and P, we can define a Fourier transform. And what we're going to propose now is a similar thing here, which is a generalized Fourier transform of the Kadama state. So here it is. So we have the Kadama state as in the A representation, and then we perform this, what we normally do for e to the I px. This would be e to the I ea, the imaginary part of A. And we integrate over A, same thing I would do if I was doing a Fourier transform, okay? And we will get psi in the E representation. So why do we do this? Why do what we want to do this? Well, instead of trying to do, we wanted to evade doing Wheeler-DeWittology, right, in the metric formulation, because I told you I didn't know how to path integrate over that. So I sidestep that, and I do all of my magic with the Kadama in the A representation, and to get to E, I just Fourier transform that. And the question is, does that work? So what we're going to do now is symmetry reduce this Fourier transform. Okay, everybody follow me so far? I propose this Fourier transform. I'm going to symmetry reduce this Fourier transform and check to see if I get back the Hartle, Hawken, and Vilenkin state in the O representation. So if you do that, so as I told you, if you, B becomes D by DA, okay? And therefore, all I have to do is when I go back, if I go back to this equation, what you find is that the Hamiltonian constraint in the A representation using this, becomes exactly what we had before. And when we perform the Fourier transform simply by taking the symmetry reduced versions. So psi B here, sorry, psi of B, remember, this is a Kadama state symmetry reduced, where B is related to the symmetry reduced connection. This is simply E dot A, symmetry reduced, and I'm integrating over DB, which is the connection symmetry reduced. So I start with my Kadama state. I simply take this generalized Fourier transform, and I claim that this is psi of A. I don't know what psi, so I'm now dealing with this object here. So what I'm gonna do now is realize that this object here is nothing more than an airy function. Okay? I'm losing something here. Where is it? There's, so in this case, T is proportional to B, okay? And Z is just this factor here. So, one second. So does everybody, is this clear to everyone what I'm doing here? I'm simply taking the Kadama state that I had before. Where is it? This state right here, right? I take the Fourier transform, I take this E dot A here, I substitute it in here, and this whole integral becomes the integral form of the airy function.
So there is a question by Laurent.
Yes, Laurent.
Hey, Stefan. So earlier you were mentioning that there's really these two states, right? One is the autolocking state that decay, and the one is this traveling state of Wilenkin.
Yeah.
Can you represent both there or only one of the two sector?
Very good. Next slide.
Okay, sorry.
So it turns out before this solution, meaning the minute I've generalized this this Kadama state to a Fourier transform, right? I have this integral to do. Now let's look at this integral a little bit here. This T is actually proportional, right? T is going to be proportional to our B. That's like B cube, and this is like B. And notice that we have this oscillating piece, e to the I b cube, right? So b cube, b has a real and imaginary part. And so this thing is highly suppressed when this term is complex. This is complex. So in this complex plane here, right? So this integral is happening over a real part and a real b and imaginary b. I can restrict myself, I can completely restrict myself to all real B's, right? And in that case, if I restrict myself to real B from negative infinity to infinity, right, I get back to Hartle-Hawkins state. If I restrict my contour to imaginary B's and along the negative imaginary axis, right, and then at zero, I my outgoing wave to real B, I get the Wilenkin state. So the Chern-Simon, the Kadama state, its Fourier transform contains both states depending on your choice of contour. Now, your choice of contour is limited, by the way, because remember, the domain of integration is only well-defined for values of in this plane where that are arguments of three times theta is greater than zero, okay? So you're gonna have three domains in a complex plane where you're allowed to integrate. And of course, it corresponds to the imaginary axis and also the real axis at a negative and positive infinity. So the upshot, the takeaway now is that the Kadama state and it's for and more precisely, its Fourier transform contains both the Hartle-Hawkins and Wilenkin state. And now Laurent and everyone else, there's a subtlety, and I don't have. So this result was first found by Joao in a symmetry reduced case, and the argument here, and I don't know. So I'm not going to throw this argument to the experts, is that. You know, the imaginary part of B corresponds to the imaginary part of the connection, right? And so the Wilenkin state seems to depend on having it, you know, basically taking a contour over the imaginary part of the connection. And so it seems that if you believe in real connections or, you know, the reality conditions that you've imposed, right, that the Wilenkin state is not preferred in the connection formulation of quantum gravity. However, I know that this is very much I would say topics of research. So I I want to just add that statement there. But the Hartle-Hawkins state is not problematic because the integration is happening only over the real axis. And remember, this is for a Lorentzian Kadama state. Okay, I'm going to, yeah.
Can I interrupt you? So there are two questions. So first Bianca and then Francesca.
Please.
Hi, Stefan.
Hello.
We usually think of the Fourier transform as a unitary transformation. So I want to ask how literally you do take that Fourier transform as a unitary transformation. So are both states which you get, Hartle-Hawking and Wilankin state, then kind of a delta function renormalizable after, you know, like the original state? Or is it two parts of something? Should I not really think of it as a unitary transform, but just as a way to compute something?
I want to think of it as a unitary transformation, but part of why I'm presenting this is to throw this at you guys to help me figure it out. Okay. I want to think of it as a unitary transformation. It seems formally to look like that because there's an I in front of it. And the original Kadama state had an I in front of it and it was delta function renormalizable.
Depends a lot on the contour, whether it's really kind of unitary or something.
That's right. Yeah. So it looks like the Hartle-Hawking contour seems fine, but the one with the imaginary contour, the Wilankin, I don't know what to say about that.
And can you, from the connection, you take only the imaginary part and the real part is a spin connection.
Yes.
That's not trivial, no? I mean, it's non-zero in the case, in the symmetry reduction you apply.
That's right.
Okay, so you do have a real part. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, we do have a real part, yes. Thanks for the question. Francesca had a question.
Yes, Stefan. I have been wondering, since you set up everything, what's the influence of the choice of self-dual variables? So is this result depending on that choice? And how would it change if instead I take the usual choice of having a Barberini parameter real there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I forgot to cite Andy Rondando did some work where he generalized the Kadama state to the real Barbero connection. And I believe that that question is, I don't know the answer, it's a good question, but I think it's worth pursuing. This was a simpler way to do it for us in terms of, being able to trace the eyes to get delta function normalizable states.
Sure, thank you.
You're welcome, good question. Okay, so I just wanna kind of just recap some things here. So the takeaway I want you to, the real takeaway here is starting with this, this proposed Fourier transform, formal Fourier transform of this delta function normalizable Kadama state, we showed that the old-fashioned way, I should not use old-fashioned, I want to make people sound old, of deriving the Hartle-Hawking and Wilankin state are just the Fourier transforms of this Kadama state, symmetry reduce. So we start with this generalized Fourier transform of this generalized state and we symmetry reduce. The question is, can we go beyond this? And so I want to now tell you about going beyond. So what we can do now is say, since we have this generalized state, let's go more general. And this is the advantage. It's very hard to do this type of game. So it's now we have a generalized triad and a generalized connection, and we don't have to path integrate over the metric. All I have to do is evaluate the Kadama state for any connection, right? Path integrate. And I'll get the corresponding wave function in the metric variables. So in the paper that we recently published with Gabe and Joao, we studied Bianchi 9, Bianchi 1. These are more generalized homogeneous and anisotropic cosmologies. They're relevant because if we want to understand in the early universe, that quantum fluctuations of the metric could have induced huge inhomogeneities so that you would deviate away from isotropy. So you might want to think about the initial condition before inflation began. You might want to you would probably want to generalize your situation and ask how the universe dynamically, and maybe there's a quantum gravity story of how the universe dynamically started off in a more generic anisotropic quantum foam, quote unquote, into the homogeneous and isotropic state that we see it in. We might want to play this game. And this is a conversation that Lawan and I have been engaging in, and we hope to continue, continuing to liberate ourselves from confusions. But there are some interesting insights already that I want to tell you about. So if we now, for example, this is just one example. If we start with Bianchi one, so Bianchi one, we can think of basically a three space with three. Where the scale factor will correspond to three different cycles of a tori. So you have three A's and they can dynamically expand and contract independent of each other. We can play the same game here. We write down the densitized triad for the three different scale factors, then the connection for the three different scale factors. We follow the commutation rules and we write down the Kadama state and take the Fourier transform, and we get the following solution. So this corresponds to performing an integral over dB, and it's basically some special functions. You end up with some like Hankel type functions, but I'm just gonna now show you a plot of this state. So the Hartle-Hawkins state now becomes not a function of just one scale factor, but this function C, which is the product. I should have my C somewhere here, and I'm gonna be upset with myself that I didn't have my C. Basically, the C is analogous basically to the product of these three scale factors. Okay. And so again, it has very similar behavior to the Hartle-Hawkins state in mini superspace. But there's an interesting caveat that I want us to pay attention to. And I think that this is now paving a direction into how we might want to move forward in quantum gravity related to asking some questions that me as a cosmologist would like to have about the early universe. If I take inflation and I look at a scalar perturbation of inflation, and I assume that that quantum perturbation above my slowly rolling scalar field, so the homogeneous mode, the zero mode of my scalar field is slowly rolling, and then I have quantum fluctuations. During inflation, we have a dirty secret in cosmology, which is that those tiny perturbations at a 10 to the minus 5 over 5, if I go back in time, they can actually become order one. And therefore I will introduce anisotropies so huge, right, that it might destroy the homogeneity that I started and I assumed for inflation. Now, this is a debate. People talk about inflation being an attractor and we don't have to worry about this. And well, I worry about it. What I would like to do is to start off in a generic situation where my universe is wild quantum fluctuations of the metric. And I want to understand from a quantum gravity perspective, how is it that the wave function evolved to become homogeneous and isotropic? Or another way of saying it, why is it that the perturbations of the metric are much smaller than order one? And I believe that this might be a pathway into that. And let me say one little insight as to why. You see, in a mini superspace situation, where I only looked at the metric, one component of the metric, and this was something, this is an observation that Laurent and I made. So if you want to, you know, critique it, Laurent will have to answer. No. The idea here is, if we look at the Kadama state, let's look at it formally. Right. So the Kadama state has an abelian piece, right, which is this dA, which is the derivative, spatial derivative with respect to the, with the connection. And it has a purely non-abelian part here. You see, you're not going to see this if you work only in the metric representation, right? So if I look now at my, if I look, for example, at the Fourier transform of my Kadama state, where is it? Yeah, the Fourier transform of the Kadama state, let me just say it in words. It is the abelian parts that dominate, okay, the path integral of the Chern-Simon state. So in homogeneous isotropic space-time, so here's what I want to think about. Imagine I start off with inflation, where the scale factor is the Sitter space, and I look at late times with respect to the Planck scale, right? So I look at late times, the universe there looks homogeneous and isotropic. I have one scale factor that parameterizes that. And what I'm saying is that the Chern-Simon state encodes that by having what we call an abelian dominance. The analog of this is if I look at the Higgs mechanism, I have a non-abelian gauge field, but when I actually break SU2 to U1, I project down to the abelian component of my connection, the Higgs of the W and Z bosons. Likewise, the Kadama state has a similar behavior. When I go from a general Kadama state to mini superspace, right, homogeneous and isotropic, I project down to the abelian part of the connection. But when I look at Bianchi spacetimes, it's actually the non-abelian parts. When I look at the different cycles, B and C of Bianchi 9, for example, the only parts that survive are the non-abelian parts. All right, so that seems to suggest that maybe in the early universe, the thing that, quantum gravity is dominated by this non, if you believe quantum gravity has to do with this Chern-Simon state or some variant of it, seems to be that the dynamics is, the action is happening with the non-abelian parts. And as the universe evolves to a more homogeneous and isotropic case, the abelian parts dominate, okay? And it leads one to wonder whether or not there's something like a quantum chaos. You know, the BKL conjecture basically says that if you look at the classical trajectories of a mixed master universe, a homogeneous and isotropic Bianchi 9 universe, that basically the evolutions become chaotic so as to wash out the inhomogeneities. We wonder if there's a quantum chaos, a version of quantum chaos happening in the early phases of the universe that leads us to this abelian part later on. Again, obviously my job here is to be Stefan and leave you with a speculation. So on that note, I wanna thank you for your time and interest. And questions, and let's open it up for some conversation if there's more time.
Nice talk. So are there questions from students?
Yeah, I love questions from students, especially questions that they might think are really bad questions to ask. Those are usually the best questions.
But for now, I don't see any question from students. So are there anyone else or comments?
I can go ahead. I'm just kind of mixed. My screens are all mixed up there. There you are, Stefan. So you said observation, but you meant something else with observation, I think. So do you want to say something about what I would call observation?
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, you know, one interesting question we can ask is if you have this new state, I mean, like, so Halliwell and Hawking, when they had the Hoddle-Hawking state, one of the first things that was done was they perturbed that wave function. They perturbed the wave function in the universe. And they were able to make contact with the power spectrum of the density perturbations. In other words, they took a scalar field, coupled it to the Hoddle-Hawking state. And this was a seminal paper. We'd want to imagine this Kadama state is related to the Hoddle, to the wave function of the universe. We want to imagine doing perturbations. And Lee and Laurent actually did that for gravitational waves. And they did find some interesting results. Modulo the issues of normalizability. It'll be good to reproduce that calculation now that we're claiming to have a Lorentzian delta function renormalizable states. So that's one path in terms of making contact with what's known already. But the idea here is to go beyond that and maybe try to define new observables that we've, so like, you know, observables that are non-local in nature, like Wilson loops, for example. So the Kadama state, actually, when we go non-perturbative, people like Ed Witten taught us how to quantize this Chern-Simon states by looking at not invariants. And it'll be interesting to see what the duals of those things are. So, because, you know, it's hard to think about how to think about what a connection Wilson loop looks like in the sitter space, right? Mm-hmm. We might want to take the dual of that by looking at maybe the flux of the electric field. And this for me was more of an exercise to exactly ask the question that you're asking Niash, which is, can we imagine new ways of constructing new observables so that we can make contact with future observations? Yes. Like, so beyond endpoint functions, right? Which is what we like to use to look for non-Gaussianities in cosmology. So can we go beyond correlation functions? Can we look at Wilson loops? Can we look at flux operators? Provided that we can make contact with Hoddle-Hawking states, right? So that's the real motivation behind all this. It's not an intellectual exercise for me.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Bianca?
I have maybe just a question about a clarification. So the original Kodama state was for the complex variables with a complex connection.
Yes.
And was stated to satisfy all the constraints you stated. So now the claim is that you can just take the imaginary part, put it in the same formula, and it satisfies the same kind of constraints?
If you choose a real Hamiltonian.
If you choose, but the Hamiltonian, wasn't it always real? I'm confused.
Yeah, so this, yeah. No, it's something that,
So what does it mean? I mean, there's one Hamiltonian in my mind, so.
Yeah, so if you look at, okay, this slide should summarize everything. So if I take my anti-self dual connection, I have A is equal to gamma plus over minus IK, right?
Okay, yeah, no, I see that it's the main part seems to be to take the real part of the curvature and the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, that's right.
But
before, and there's another part, there's an imaginary part, there's so in the real Hamiltonian,
what happens with this imaginary part, because it used to be part of the constraint, no?
Yeah, so it's still there.
Or maybe,
yeah, that, no, okay. That's that equation is not there. So the one that's with the lapse function. Okay. So for that will be the imaginary part of A.
If I may. Remember the imaginary part is in fact contained to the Gauss law.
So it's a spin connection. Okay, yeah, are you saying it's automatically satisfied or not?
Well, it's going to be satisfied. What Stefan is doing is that he's saying you only need to integrate around the real part of the contour for E.
Uh-huh.
If the Gauss law is satisfied.
Because
it's a Gauss law,
it satisfies the Gauss law, so it is.
Okay, it's so you're saying something like the imaginary part of the Hamiltonian is vanishing on the Gauss constraint type of surface.
Yes, Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks for clearing it up. Now, I don't know like how, you know, kosher that is, but that's a construction.
That would have been maybe my next question.
Yeah.
Are there more thoughts, Daniel?
Yeah, does the generalized Hartle-Hawking state include is there a generalization of the Lincoln state as well? And is that included in this generalized Hartle-Hawking, or are those two separate? Like when you go beyond mini superspace, are those two kind of different wave functions?
Well, I'm very proud because this is my brand new grad student, Tats, who came from MIT to join us at Brown. And it's a very good question. So thanks for asking that question, Tats. You're going to get some brownie points. I'm just kidding. So basically this Vilenkin state, if I look at this generalized Fourier transform of the Kadama state, right? It's this generalized Airy function, and depend on, so this integral is over, a complex and a real and a complex axis, right? So for the complex plane, and depending on, you know, this, whether, you know, the augment, the angle in the complex plane, and that defines my contour. And if you take this, the real axis as my contour, I get the Hartle-Hawking state. And if I take, if I integrate from the imaginary negative axis and the real axis, I get the Vilenkin state. So it contains both, depending on the contour. So the answer is yes.
Can I, maybe I guess the way I understood the question of Daniel is that, and I think you hinted at that, you're saying, well, when I go now beyond mini superspace, the first contour exists because it's the usual
feature. Yeah.
But the second one, we have no, I mean, it doesn't, you know, you cannot take complex contour in infinite dimensional space. Nobody knows how to define that. So, or it relates to the question of Bianca. The first contour is just a change of polarization for each transform. And the second one has no mathematical meaning beyond mini superspace.
Yes. Yes.
Where you wanted to go. So at least.
Yes.
That one state is much more behave or.
Yes, the Hartle-Hawking state. This one here is the Hartle-Hawking state. If you stay along the real axis as well. So Bianca, I'm just curious to hear what your concerns are, if any.
Picked on me. I would have to understand indeed how you can change the Kondama state from being in the full connection to just the imaginary part. That is a very interesting claim. So and then as I mentioned, if you it's of course super interesting. I guess that was a result of Joao, that you can transform the Kodama state and get the Hartle-Hawking state. And if one can do that, even with some preservation of norm, I mean that would address some long-standing questions, no, about
yes,
normalization and quantum cosmology. Having an inner product.
Yes, let me add something to that. Joao showed in a mini superspace case, and in the recent paper, that was the paper where we generalized it to any full connection and the triad, densitized triad. And one question that I guess the question I have is, what is not, well, it's not a question, it's normally when we Fourier transform right? We're obviously the transform happens on a space, right? And this transform is formally seems to be happening on a space of connections.
Yes.
And I think that, are we restricting the space of connections now in some way that's dual to E? And that's this is more a question I have for you and others that think more technically about this question. Mm-hmm. What progress is being made in that direction?
Well, it depends on whether you ask in full space or in this mini superspace.
Well, I want to know the real answer in the full space.
Okay. Well, then we do things with spinnet works and so on, and it's a bit different from this continuum picture.
Right.
Yeah, which then indeed, maybe it's possible to generalize it to this spin network picture.
Okay, so.
You know, then the spin networks are just the Fourier transform of the connection presentation.
Oh, that would be very interesting then. So have people looked at, I think Carlo and Antonino and Francesca looked at Bianchi in the spin network. Didn't y'all look at spin, right?
There's various loop quantum cosmology and things in both variables. This is symmetry reduced, of course. And the question is, how much can you do non-symmetry reduced?
Yeah. I think Francesca did some work on this, didn't she?
Yeah. Well, of course there is all the big machine or loop quantum cosmology, which anisotropic models have been studied in much detail. And in particular, there is a very interesting feature that involves the specific form of the states for the Bianchi models that have been studied by Ed Wilson-Ewing. But I have been doing with Eugenio and Carlo, and then also with more work with Antonino and others, is more close to what you have, because we are in effect just writing down the a Lorentzian Hart-Hodgkin state in spin form. So, and there is also a Bianchi version of that, even though then the exact identification of what degrees of freedom corresponds to what, it's always tricky, because in fact, what is nice and what is the richness of the model that I suppose you have also here is that in fact we have more degrees of freedom than just the 3-1 of Bianchi 1, or even more than Bianchi 9. As you said, Antonino made a very nice detailed work back, not with the spin form model, but with the original canonical model, which we worked many, many years ago. So it would be nice, of course, to draw connections between what you're doing now and what is in the literature.
Oh yeah, because we actually, in this recent paper, we completely write down the Bianchi 9 for this Fourier general Fourier transform thing. And I'm really curious as to why only the non-abelian parts of the Chern-Simon state survive.
There's a question.
Now, a question. Yes, by a student, Hank.
Yep.
Oops. Hello?
Yes.
Yes. This might be a pretty stupid question, but is like when you're doing the Fourier transform, like is the connection flat?
Yes.
Okay, I see. So because I've seen somewhere, like in string theory, where the moduli space of flat connections is like an elliptic curve, right? So then you can sort of understand Fourier transform in that way.
Oh, that's very interesting. Is this for a non-abelian connection?
Yeah, I think so. SQN, I believe.
Could you email me and Laurent that paper?
Yeah, I think it's a textbook.
Oh, I don't know if I'm willing to buy that textbook.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you said okay, that's interesting.
You can email the textbook too.
Okay.
Yeah, but the thing is, I don't, because it's related to like a lot of I don't think at least I'm not aware of people doing Fourier transforms, at least that deeply on elliptic curves and stuff like that. That's related to like string theory duality, A brain to B brain stuff. Yeah, so. Yeah.
Those things are related to Chern-Simons theory.
Yeah,
topological strings, yes. I don't know much about them, but I did listen to a seminar once about it.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's very interesting. Yeah, if you have my email, it's easy to find.
Okay. Just
Google my name and shoot me an email with that book.
Okay, I'll try to dig it up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, are there more questions?
There are no more questions. I look forward to being with you all in the near future when the dust settles, and wish you all, health and I look forward to being there in person with the hockey stick, with the proverbial hockey stick, and thanks for your time.
Thank you
very much for your talk and the discussion.
Thank you.